All right, we're going to continue with Haggai, chapter 2, verses 10 through 23. This is the fourth week we're working on the prophets of the restoration. We're going to finish Haggai tonight, but we want to look at verses 10 through 23 of chapter 2. And in preparation for that, I just want to remind you that there are four prophecies. We've looked at the first and the second. Now we're going to look at the third and fourth. The fourth is actually quite small in comparison. It's really the last four verses of this chapter. These two prophecies are actually a little bit different from the first two. First two were more general. Obviously, they were earlier than the last two. They're given to us in the order that they occurred, at least as best we can tell. The last two are actually, as we'll see, from the same period, the same day, really. But they're clearly two different prophecies. There are some interesting things that we'll note when we start looking at the third prophecy regarding the timing, and we'll start to look at some of the differences that are there. One thing that I do think is very much of interest, these last two, as we'll see, are no longer focused or aimed at the country or the Jews who've returned generally, the 50,000 or so that returned to rebuild at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. These two are specifically addressed prophecies, and we'll see to whom in just a moment. There are some other things that I think are notable, not least of which I want to talk about when we get to the last prophecy, and we want to talk a little bit more about Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel is going to be addressed separately in that last prophecy. And I say separately, he's not going to be addressed with Joshua, the high priest. So, in addition to that, he's going to be addressed without reference to his lineage, as he was in the first two. And I think that's somewhat significant. Now, I'll explain why when we get to that. Now, I want you to remember what we're talking about. We're talking about a prophecy, or a series of prophecies regarding the rebuilding of the Second Temple. And that's really the subject of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. That rebuilding of the Second Temple is a type of the antitype. The antitype is Christ / the church, the gospel era. There's a transition from the legal administration of the covenant of grace and Mosaic economy to the gospel administration, and that's being prefigured here in certain ways, and we'll see that again as we go through these prophecies. So that's an important theme. But there is this remote application. I would even say that it's a remote, it's the remote fulfillment, which is the fulfillment that in fact will do justice to everything that we're reading. And that is the millennial reign, when the nations are in covenant with God in Christ, when the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord Jesus Christ, when all of the kingdoms of the world are bowing and professing the true religion. So we do want to look at that. I'm particularly interested in that angle as we go through this. And so while I'm not denying that there is an immediate referent. I am saying the immediate referent is typical. The immediate reference of the gospel era is the antitype that the type is pointing toward. But the more remote reference is really the thing that is consequential in terms of the fulfillment of the prophecy. In other words, as important as the coming of the gospel era is, the gospel era is not really going to have its full course and full effect until the millennium. And that means that remote fulfillment to which the antitype itself is now prophetic, that is ultimately what is in view and important. And what we read in Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, not only do they inform the coming of the gospel, but they really have they have a number of things to say that correspond very much with what John had to say in Revelation, and a bit to what Daniel talks about in his prophecies regarding the coming of the Messianic Kingdom and the unfolding of history to the extent that he addresses that. So, I want to begin now with verse 10, chapter 2, Haggai 2, verse 10. And then we'll work our way through the rest of these.
Haggai 2, verse 10. And in the 420th day of the 9th month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying.
Okay, so, we're now to the 420th day of the 9th month. Remember, the second prophecy was in the 7th month, the 21st day of that month. And that very much was corresponding to the time of Tabernacles. Now we're really moving beyond 2 months, beyond that prophecy. We're the 9th month, which is called Kislev, which is sort of between our November, December, sort of straddling the two. This prophecy was approximately 3 months from the time that the temple commenced the rebuilding. from the time of the first prophecy when Haggai comes and sort of kicks them into beginning again. Remember, they had gotten discouraged, they had stopped, and he's trying to get them going again. So there's a 3-month period of time now at this point in Haggai, and that really represents the entirety of Haggai's ministry. It's just a short window. Now, the very fact that that's a short window, I think, is significant in terms of what leads to the millennium. He's talking about a lot of the things that need to occur in order to the millennial reign. There are some interesting things about this. The weather at this time, November, December, that's the weather that's going to determine what kind of crop yield they're going to have the following year, because this is a time where they're waiting for the early rain, the rain on the newly sown crops. It's also notable here, by the way, that Zechariah actually began prophesying his first prophecy. If we look at Zechariah 1, verses 2 to 6, we can see that his first prophecy actually occurs between the second prophecy, which we covered last time, and the third and fourth, which we're going to cover tonight. So Zechariah 1, 2 through 6.
Zechariah chapter 1, verses 2 through 6. The Lord hath been sore displeased with your father, with your fathers. Therefore say thou unto them, thus saith the Lord of hosts, turn ye unto me, saith the Lord of hosts. And I will turn unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. Be not as your fathers, unto whom the former prophets have cried, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Turn ye now from your evil ways and from your evil doings. But they did not hear nor hearken unto me, saith the Lord. Your fathers, where are they? And the prophets, do they live forever? But my words and my statutes, which I commanded my servants, the prophets, did they not take hold of your fathers? And they returned and said, Like as the Lord of hosts thought to do unto us, according to our ways and according to our doings, so hath he dealt with us.
Okay, so that was in the eighth month, right? So the previous prophecy was the seventh month. Zechariah was in the eighth month. Now we're in the ninth month, and Haggai's back again. Now, again, Haggai's ministry is really anticipatory of the millennium period. It's very much a ministry which is going to have some sort of analogous relation to that period of time between the end of the apostasy and the beginning of the millennium. And so it's just a small period of time. If you remember when we talked about Revelation, there's going to be some period of time when the 1260 years ends, approximately 75 years. Daniel talks about 1290 and then 1335. Those is the 75-year period. And it appears that Haggai is really, in a sense, anticipating that period of time. And his subject matter really has to do with all of the preparation. The apostasy, in a sense, is over, right? They're starting to come back to rebuild the temple. What has to happen? So that's that's very much of interest here. We see as well that Zechariah's ministry, which is going to have more bearing on the millennial age, the millennial era. Zechariah's ministry commences right sort of in the middle of Haggai's very brief ministry. There's a little bit of overlap here. By the way, Malachi, whose ministry is separated from Haggai and Zechariah by some period of time, his ministry is after a bit of a gap, and his ministry, not only is it talking about the great and coming day of the Lord in terms of the New Testament, but it's also anticipatory of Judgment Day. Right? So at the end of the millennium, as we reach the end of the millennium, what are we going to be looking for? What's going to happen then? Malachi has something, I think, to say about that. the next transition, if you will, from the gospel era to the eternal state. So, we have a bit of a difference now with these two prophecies. We see it here in the 4th and 20th day of the 9th month, the second year of Darius. Which, by the way, the second year of Darius, remember we're talking about regal years, and Zechariah is in the eighth month of Darius, so we know we're talking about the same regal years. It's Darius the king. He's the first one in the line, but remember Darius is like Caesar or Pharaoh. It's just a Persian title. But here, unlike the previous two accounts where we read that the word of the Lord came by the prophet Haggai. Came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet saying. The Hebrew here does not say, as it did in the previous two announcements, by the hand of Haggai. It just simply says here, unto Haggai. And I think that there's a reason for this. The first is there's clearly a change of audience from the remnant of the 50,000 and everyone else, specifically to the officers of the church here, and then to the magistrate. And that's very important. The ministry of the witnessing church is to the magistrate and to the ministry. Right? It's the two sons of oil, which we'll see in Zechariah, which is a theme that comes up in Revelation 11. So, First, the message is to the officers of the church, as we'll see. Now, the work had begun, but again, it's flagging, if you remember in the previous prophecy, that there's concern about comparison with the first temple. And the previous prophecy had addressed that, but now we're going to get a promise designed to lift the spirits concerning the removal of the famine and confirmation about the glory that will accrue to the second temple and the place of the magistrate in the rebuilding of this temple. In addition to this language by the hand of Haggai, the fact that it's coming unto Haggai, and it's going to the ministry and to the magistracy, I think what we can see here is that not only is there this outward, but in this sense, I think there's a hint that there's an inward call being issued in this prophecy. In other words, it's a little bit more direct. The word of the Lord is coming unto him. It's not just coming by him. It's coming unto him. He's talking to them. I don't think it's missed by them at this point now that he's speaking on behalf of the Lord. So, what's happening appears to be this. They heard him as one who claimed to be a prophet of God. Now, in these two examples, I think they're hearing him and they know that he's a prophet of God. Whatever's transpired in that little bit of time has begun to make that clear. Right, we want to look now at verse 11.
Haggai 2, verse 11. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, ask now the priest concerning the law, saying.
Yeah. Ask now the priest concerning the law, saying. Why is this important? Well, remember, it was the duty of the priest to be expert in the law. In fact, they were charged with expounding and unfolding various details of the law. We see that if we look at Leviticus 10, verse 11, and also at Ezekiel 44, verse 23. We can see the charge that's given to the priests concerning the law.
Leviticus 10:11, and that ye may teach the children of Israel all the statutes which the Lord hath spoken unto them by the hand of Moses. Ezekiel 44:23, and they shall teach my people the difference between the holy and profane, and cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean.
Right, so their job is to expound the law, to help people set a distinction. And now, the Lord of hosts is saying to Haggai, ask the priests this. Right, so now, he's addressing them directly and specifically. Not just the 50,000 or the Jews that have returned, the remnant. But he's got in his sight specifically the people who are officers of the church. They're the authoritative teachers, or the spiritual leaders of the Jews. In addition, and this is part of what is presumed in the questions, it was their job, your priest, you had to prepare and offer all of the sacrifices that were required under the Mosaic economy. Now, the questions that are going to be asked in the next couple of verses are designed to address certain errors which the Jews held regarding inherent efficacy of the ordinances and sacrifices. They thought, if you remember, for example, Jeremiah complains about this. Their boast, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord is ours. We have the temple of the Lord, and therefore everything is going to be fine. Well, it's not the case. You know, you may have the temple of the Lord, but that doesn't mean it's all going to go well. And there are reasons for that. First of all, right, they're relying on a ceremonial observance, which is already provisional. It's typical. And remember, this prophecy, although it's about building the second temple, it's really about bringing in the gospel era and ultimately about bringing in the gospel era in its fullness, that is the millennium. And so, if you get too focused on the sign, you can miss the importance of what's going on. It's sort of like if you're driving and you see a red light and you are so focused on the fact that the light just changed from green to red that you forget that red means stop and you drive through it. You've missed the point, right? You've stopped on the outward thing and focused on that and you've missed the meaning. Well, if you do that with a red light, that can get you or somebody else or a bunch of people killed. But if you do what the Jews are doing, it's going to get you thrown into hell. And so Haggai is going to address this, and this has bearing on what they're doing with building the temple. So look at verse 12.
Verse 12. If one bear holy flesh in the skirt of his garment, and with his skirt you touch bread or pottage or wine or oil or any meat, shall it be holy? And the priest answered and said, no.
Okay, so the first question for the priest is this. And the question, notice he raises a question about holy flesh. What he's talking about is meat that has been prepared and set apart for offering to the Lord. Now, he's referring to a practice here, which we can actually find in Scripture. If we look at Leviticus 6, verse 27. What the priest did normally in the preparation of the meat, in order to carry the meat from the place where they prepared it to where they were going to offer it up, is they would wrap it in their garment, their outer garment. They would carry it from one place to the other. And there's a reason for that that we're going to talk about in just a moment. But go ahead, if you have Leviticus 6, 27.
Whatsoever shall touch the flesh thereof shall be holy. And when there is sprinkled of the blood thereof upon any garment, thou shalt wash that whereon it was sprinkled in the holy place.
Okay, so wrapping it in the holy garment is a good way to keep it from becoming defiled as you move from one place to the other. All right? And that's really setting up this question a little bit. If you know what they're doing, Haggai very clearly knows what is going to happen in this temple. But once they get these sacrifices going again, he knows how the priests are going to operate. And so Haggai asks this. If these garments, which have now touched the holy flesh, right, moving it from one place to another, if these garments now should come into contact with something else, be it bread or pottage, wine, oil, or meat, his question is, will any of those things now be made holy simply by having touched the garment which had touched the holy flesh? And to this, the priests answer no. Now, this is an important question. Why? What are the ceremonies really? Well, these are outward means of conveying what is inherently holy. They're not holy abstractly considered. They're holy because of the fact that God inhabits the temple. They're holy because there is a contact with the divine. So now if I take these ceremonial things, but it's no longer in contact with that which is actually holy, right? Set apart. Can these things make me clean? The point of their no is they understood this. Things which are unholy cannot be made holy simply by coming in contact with things that carry or contain holy things. For example, like the temple. Okay, so now this is Calvin, I think, made this comment. It's a very hard thing for men to accept that no matter how clean things are ceremonially, that they can't make anything else clean or holy. Right? That cuts at the heart of man's religiosity. We think that, you know, somehow we can make things holy simply by touching. And by the way, this has bearing on things like hymn singing. People who think that, you know, our sincerity, our religious desire, that somehow that could make this holy just because we're involved in religious worship, which is holy. You know, just because we actually pray, for example, that would make hymn singing, therefore, holy. Well, no, it doesn't. Right? The answer is no. Because outward ceremonies, no matter what we do, we declare this a worship of God, blah, blah, blah. That can't make something holy that was not previously holy. All our saying so will never make that happen. And that means that if you're working on the temple, is that making you holy? Because you're working on the temple? Well, a lot of the Jews probably thought yes. These are important questions because these are questions that are being raised in anticipation of the change from type and shadow to spirit and truth. When it comes to the worship of God, the administration of the covenant of grace, the move from the Mosaic economy to the gospel era. They have to get this point. Now, the very fact that they're worried about this second temple not being what it should be, what does that tell you? They're focused on the outward. They're focused on what they can see. And yet, as I pointed out before, this temple is the temple into which Christ himself will come. There's a greater glory there. Right? That's greater than that Shekinah, the theophany of God in the temple. This is God incarnate, tabernacling with man, dwelling in a tent of flesh, coming to talk to man. Right, look at verse 13, because this is the question with which this is paired.
Haggai 2, verse 13. Then said Haggai, if one that is unclean by a dead body touch any of these, shall it be unclean? And the priests answered and said, it shall be unclean.
Now, the reason for asking the second question is to attempt to define our subject matter, the parameters of what is good and acceptable. Haggai now asks this question. If you're someone who is unclean, and he brings up the reason of touching a dead body, but it could be any unclean thing, but this one, we've got a lot of precedent that we'll see in just a moment, right? If the same now should touch bread or pottage, wine, oil, meat, shall it be made unclean? In other words, you've got these priestly garments, you're a priest, and you've touched now something unclean. Can your garments now, remember they couldn't transmit holiness, but can they transmit uncleanness? And the priests answer, yes. And again, they're right about that. It's very much in keeping with the law. Look at Numbers 9:22, Leviticus 11:28, and Leviticus 22:4-7. Numbers 19:22, Leviticus 11:28, and Leviticus 22:4-7.
Numbers 19, verse 22, and whatsoever the unclean person touches shall be unclean, and the soul that touches it shall be unclean until even.
Leviticus 11, verse 28. And he that beareth the carcass of them shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the even. They are unclean unto you.
Leviticus 22, verses 4 through 7. What man soever of the seed of Aaron is a leper or hath a running issue, he shall not eat of the holy things until he be clean. And whosoever touches anything that is unclean by the dead, or a man whose seed goeth from him, or whosoever toucheth any creeping thing whereby he may be made unclean, or a man of whom he may take uncleanness, whatsoever uncleanness he hath, the soul which hath touched any such shall be unclean until even, and shall not eat of the holy things, unless he wash his flesh with water. And when the sun is down, he shall be clean, and shall afterward eat of the holy things, because it is his food.
Okay, so it's notable here, right? There is no direct contact. And yet, should the garment be made unclean by touching the body, in this case, should that garment come in contact with the items listed, the bread, the pottage, the wine, the oil, the meat, they are made unclean by that contact. So, while the ceremonial, the form, while that cannot convey holiness, uncleanness is transmitted by men. It defiles men every way they turn. Everything they touch is defiled. Now, this is an important point as well, because not only is he really saying this, not only are you not being made clean by working on the temple, this temple, you're defiling it. Now that raises a very serious question. You start to think about that. How is any temple built with hands? How are any of these temples really going to be used for making an atonement? See, if you think about these questions, it should be making you ask, how can a man be just with God? How can I be right with God if that's the case? Never thought about it like that before. But if that's the case, that means every time I try to work on this temple, I'm defiling it. Everything I do is defiling, which means that every sacrifice I want to offer is going to be defiled. Or should be, based on this principle. Of course, if it wasn't for the interposition of the ceremonial holiness, that would be true. But the ceremonies don't have an inherent power. Now, by the way, this is exactly the point that's in view when you remember in the Gospels, the woman with the issue of blood, she touches Jesus. Right? According to this law, what should have happened? He should have been made unclean. And yet, what actually happens? Under the gospel, she is made clean. It's a total reversal. It's an object lesson in contrast to what Haggai is talking about here. All right, so verse 14. Haggai 2:14.
Haggai 2, verse 14. Then answered Haggai and said, so is this people, and so is this nation before me, saith the Lord, and so is every work of their hands, and that which they offer there is unclean.
Okay, so Haggai answers them now and says, look, this is a thus saith the Lord. He's saying, so is this people, and so is this nation before me, and so is every work of their hands, and that which they offer there, that is, in the temple, is unclean. So, he hears the priest replying according to the law. In other words, they know the law, right? But they're not really thinking about what that entails. And Haggai, as the voice of the witnessing church, his job is to get them thinking. So he brings forth a word directly from the Lord, which is going to make application of principles. And basically saying, look, contrary to what the people might have thought, right, the outward observances, including their building of the temple, could not sanctify them. Can't be. In fact, if we really think about this, their pollutions could unhallow or unsanctify even that which they were accomplishing. Right? So working on building the temple wouldn't necessarily mean that they were being sanctified. They were defiled. They were defiled precisely because they were lacking a proper frame to do the work of the Lord. And that's made clear if we look, for example, at Psalm 51, verses 16 and 17. Psalm 51, 16 and 17.
Psalm 51, 16 and 17. For thou desirest not sacrifice, else would I give it. Thou delightest not in burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise.
Yeah, so God is looking not on the outward, but on the inward. And this is really the problem that they have. They're focused on the outward again and again and again. Everything they offered at the temple was like them, defiled or unclean. Those who build the house of the Lord must have clean hearts. But again, how is a man made righteous with God? How can an unclean man become holy? These are the questions that are being raised by this. How is this temple going to surpass in glory that of the first temple? You see, the prophecy can't stop at this second temple. It doesn't work. You know, we've already been told, it's been hinted at visually, it's just not going to be enough. That's not just the concern that people have with Haggai. When we read in Ezra and Nehemiah, when the temple's finished, the men who remembered it weep because it's nothing in comparison with that first temple. So the outward, it's clearly not outwardly. Now that's part of the problem, by the way, that people have with the gospel, right? They want to add liturgies, they want to add incense, they want to have musical instruments, they want to have all this other stuff, their holy days. Why? Because they're focused on the outward. They don't get this connection and this idea that the New Testament is concerned about the inward, the spiritual realities. Something very interesting now occurs. By the way, I think before I move on, I just want to say, that's also a problem with premillennialists. You know, they don't think that there could be a millennium without Jesus being physically present. They're focused on his bodily presence. They're focused on the veil of the flesh. They're not focused on that spiritual presence which he has by way of his ascension. So they're missing the point about that millennial era. All right, verse 15.
Haggai 2:15. Now I pray you consider from this day and upward from before a stone was laid upon a stone in the temple of the Lord.
I pray you consider from this day and upward from before a stone was laid upon a stone in the temple of the Lord. Now, I'm going to tell you, there a lot of the critical commentators think that the next few verses are somehow out of order. And they think that because they too are focused, their entire focus is on the building of the second temple. The fact that they're confused over this, I think, argues again for the very fact that I think should be central when we look at this, and that is Haggai is looking through that second temple, and in some sense through the inauguration of the gospel era to the full glory of the gospel era in the millennium. All right? Haggai actually, though, now is merely calling the priest to lay at the heart. So the word consider here, that he's saying consider from this day, saying lay at the heart. Think about this. Not in a passing way, but really lay at the heart. Think about the situation. Consider the situation since they began to rebuild the temple. And the language here is stone upon stone. We see, if we look at Ezra 6, verse 4. So Ezra 6, verse 4 is really the reference point in some respects to what he's talking about here. Ezra 6, 4.
Ezra 6, verse 4. With three rows of great stones and a row of new timber, and let the expenses be given out of the king's house.
Remember, there's a big period of time. There's a laying of the foundation, and there's a gap before they finish the second temple. Right? Which, again, I think is... there's something analogous going on with the gospel era. But Haggai's saying, look, remember the condition you were in prior to obeying God and working on the temple. Okay, recall, for example, the things that we read about in the first prophecy, the poverty, the famine, all of the adverse providences. These weren't just cosmic zingers coming in and whacking you with no reference to anything. These are actually signs of God's punishment for sin. Look at providence and read it aright. We can misread providence, but we can also ignore providence and fail to grasp there is a connection. And so while we shouldn't just stop at providence, we should read it in light of Scripture. The fact is that providence does, in fact, have the possibility of teaching us something if we pay attention. All right, look at verse 16. Haggai 2:16.
Haggai 2:16. Since those days were when one came to an heap of 20 measures, there were but 10. When one came to the press vat for to draw out 50 vessels out of the press, there were but 20.
Okay, so Haggai raises very specific things about the famine, and he points out it affected the yield both in grain and grapes, wheat and wine. These are the two staples of the people. These are the things they need most for basic survival. If you're a desert-dwelling people at this time, you need some very basic things to make it through the year. Wheat and wine are these two things, and the futility of their efforts is noted by the dramatic losses they sustained. Like their expectations are really brought to naught. You expect to get 20 measures of wheat, and you get 10. You think you're going to get 50 vessels out of the press from the grapes, and they're 20. You've invested more than you're getting back. You're losing ground. If this keeps going on, you're not going to have anything to sow. You're going to have to eat all the seed just to survive. You're going to have to drink everything right away. You're not going to be able to save anything. You're not going to have any thing. There's not going to be any surplus. No possibility here. Well, verse 17 is pretty explicit as to why. Haggai 2:17.
I smote you with blasting, with mildew, with hail, and all the labors of your hand, yet ye turned not to me, saith the Lord.
So, we're told these are the divine judgments that are coming against the Jews. Blasting. What is blasting? Blasting is really, literally, it's talking about an east wind, which is coming from the desert. And an east wind coming from the desert is hot. Right? It's blasting. Mildew is really a word that's noting that greenish-yellow color that plants, grains get when they have this withering blight, this disease that affects them. Hail. Well, the hail, the effects of that we know from Psalm 78, verse 47.
He destroyed their vines with hail and their sycamore trees with frost.
Yeah, so the hail would have torn the grapevines to shreds. And it would have just destroyed, it would have knocked all the grapes off. So all of these things, if they were rightly improved, that is, rightly reflected upon, they should have been recognized from the hand of the Lord. Look at Amos 4, verse 9.
Amos 4, verse 9. I have smitten you with blasting and mildew, when your gardens and your vineyards and your fig trees and your olive trees increased. The palmer worm devoured them, yet have they not returned unto me, saith the Lord.
Okay, so... Everything for which they labored was in vain. This is not some sort of new way that God is choosing to punish them. He's done this before. Prophets before have talked about this. The works of their unclean hands have brought divine judgments, but the fact is this, they were blind to it. They couldn't turn back to the Lord. They didn't turn back. They need the prophet to tell them. They're just not getting it. Look at verse
18. Haggai 2, verse 18. Consider now from this day and upward, from the 24th day of the 9th month, even from the day that the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid, consider it.
Again, consider, he's saying, consider, lay to heart. Everything which has happened since the foundation of the temple was laid. Now remember, this is the second year of Darius, 9th month. He refers them back to the second year of Cyrus, which we can read about in Ezra 3, verse 10.
Ezra 3, verse 10. And when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, they set the priests in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals to praise the Lord after the ordinance of David, king of Israel.
Okay, so the... In the second year of Cyrus, the foundation is laid, but now it's the second year of Darius. We've got an entire kingdom, if you will, out of the way. And we're moving on to the Persians, and they're now overseeing what needs to be done to get this temple built. But during this time, from the 420th day of the 9th month, which is when this prophecy is, thinking all the way back to the laying of the foundation in the second year of Cyrus, right? What he's saying is, look, your inattention to building the house of God, the willingness of the people to be put off from this for the slightest of reasons, that's really why you're facing economic crisis and famine. Right? Disobedience had brought them to dire straits. That's the bottom line. All right. Now, to underscore this, and really to encourage them at this juncture, we have this statement in verse 19. Haggai 2:19.
Haggai 2, verse 19. Is the seed yet in the barn? Yea, as yet the vine and the fig tree and the pomegranate and the olive tree hath not brought forth, from this day will I bless you.
Okay, so the new crop had just been sown. It was awaiting the early rain. Remember the early rain, the latter rain. The harvest was not yet gathered. Okay, so there's nothing visible to confirm the blessings that are being promised here, right? They're very early on in the cycle. But they've just had a terrible harvest. And it sounds like it's not the first time. I want you to note, however, here, the emphasis upon the seed. The result of building the second temple is what? Well, they're going to have a lot of seed for planting. It's a lot of seed to sow. So it ends, this prophecy ends with this promise that God's blessing will be upon their obedience. Make no mistake. That's the promise to the church in Haggai's day, to the leaders of the church. This will, you may not see it at the beginning. It may look and it may seem counterintuitive even. But you have to trust God. Don't look simply on the outward. You have to consider the promise of God. Be like Abraham, not considering the deadness of his body, but looking to the promise of God. This is what they're being commanded to do. And that leaves us with the last prophecy in Haggai, which is relatively short, and yet I think it has some interesting things to add to this. So we want to look at verse 20, Haggai 2, verse 20.
Haggai 2, verse 20. And again the word of the Lord came unto Haggai in the 24th day of the month, saying.
So again, the language in the Hebrew says, once more here, unto Haggai and not by the hand of Haggai. Same thing is going on. Now, he's just talked to the church leaders. Now he's going to talk to the political leader, the ministry and the magistrate. It's given the same day as the third prophecy. And that, too, I think, is somewhat significant, right? The magistrate is being addressed at the same time as the minister. You know, it's not as if one is being addressed and has to go through and do all these things before the other can start. There's really this idea that they're, in a sense, going to work together, although clearly I think the church has a bit of leadership here, helping the magistrate know what to do. So the second prophecy had spoken of the shaking of the nations, all the political turmoil that's going to arise as a result of the building of this temple, or in conjunction with the building of this temple. The fourth prophecy here is actually addressed to the political leader of Israel, and that too is important. There is something. We're looking through the political dynasty, if you will, of Israel at this point. Right? And there's some interesting things I think we need to consider here about Zerubbabel, which we will in this next verse. So look at verse 21.
Haggai 2, verse 21. Speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I will shake the heavens and the earth.
Okay, so now there's a direct word from God given to Zerubbabel. Remember his name? Sown in Babylon. He's the governor of Judah. He's the governor of Judah who, by the way, we find him if we look at Matthew 1:12 and even Luke 3:27 for that matter. We can find him in both sides of the lineage of Christ. So Matthew 1:12 and Luke 3:27.
Matthew 1, verse 12. And after they were brought to Babylon, Jeconiah begat Salathiel, and Salathiel begat Zerubbabel.
Luke 3, verse 27, which was the son of Joanna, which was the son of Resa, which was the son of Zerubbabel, which was the son of Salathiel, which was the son of Neri.
Okay, so either way we look, Zerubbabel's in this lineage. Why? He's building the temple. He's involved with the building of the temple, literally, his own body. Because remember the temple, Jesus speaks of the temple, tear down this temple in 3 days, I'm going to build it again. He's talking about the temple of his body. Right? that's what this is pointing to. And he's in that line. And yet, even though he's in the line of David, he cannot be crowned king. He's the leader of God's people in the rebuilding of the second temple. But the one crowned in the rebuilding of the second temple, as we'll see if we look at Zechariah 6, verse 13, one who is to be crowned in the rebuilding of the second temple is not the one who is descended from the line of David, but the one who's going to be crowned is going to be crowned a priest. Look at Zechariah 6:13.
Zechariah 6, verse 13. Even he shall build the temple of the Lord, and he shall bear the glory, and shall sit and rule upon his throne, and he shall be a priest upon his throne, and a council of peace shall be between them both.
Okay. Council of peace shall be between them both. We're going to talk about that stuff in Zechariah more when we get to Zechariah, in this passage in Zechariah. But I want you to consider this. The second temple is pointing to a time when kings are going to rule on behalf of the great high priest who's been crowned. What's his name? Joshua. What's his name in Greek? Jesus. Okay. There's no mistaking. This is typology, which is prophetical. Right. There's something more elaborate going on here. It's pointing to something different. Coinciding then with the building of this temple, there's to be the convulsing of nations, which is going to extend throughout the earth. And this comes up again, I mean, here in this verse, I'll shake the heavens and the earth. If you remember, we talked about that. That was back in verse 6. It's really talking about the kingdoms of the world bringing their wealth and strength to serve the people of God as a result. So what is being said here is that as a result of this political turmoil that will accompany the building of the second temple, nations are going to be brought to serve under the salutary effects of the gospel. They're going to be brought into the kingdom to serve. And that's the millennium. Right? Let's look at verse 22. This imagery doesn't just stop there. Verse 22.
Haggai 2:22, and I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms, and I will destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the heathen, and I will overthrow the chariots and those that ride in them, and the horses and their riders shall come down, every one by the sword of his brother.
So what is God saying here? He's declaring he's going to overthrow the thrones of kingdoms. Not just the kingdoms, but the thrones. That's their governments, the very thing which binds men together as nations. It's going to overthrow them. The strength of nations. That phrase refers to armies. That's the strength of nations. The chariots here are the chariots of war. Chariots are used for war. Now, look at this. The method of bringing down the nations is told succinctly here. Every man would be brought down by the sword of his brother. This is Armageddon. This is the language of Armageddon. Right? There'll be wars which are destructive and self-destructive. It's going to be mutually assured destruction. The heathen nations are going to reduce one another by means of war so that their armies are decimated.
Quick question. Do you think that nuclear war would be involved in that?
It's possible. I wouldn't rule it out. I don't think it's necessary, but I wouldn't rule it out. People are most prone to display their depravity in the passions of war. So as the temple is building, the kingdoms of this world are being brought low. So we reach the end of the apostasy, in other words, this lull, the 75-year period. What should we expect? Well, as there's a gearing up for the building of the temple, the nations are going to be in unprecedented turmoil, which is what's going to bring about, ultimately, the converting of the Jews and then the fullness of the Gentile nations. They're going to reduce one another. How are they going to do it? Well, part of that mix is going to be Armageddon. And they're going to be fighting amongst one another. So Zerubbabel here is a type, but that type is pointing to an antitype. And that antitype is really is Christ. That he is in fact the one who's going to rule through them, I should say. Zerubbabel is like the nations of the earth, but nations that are now ruling on behalf of Christ. And that, I think, that is borne out in the last verse here. We see a little bit more of what's in view. Look at verse 23.
Haggai 2:23. In that day, saith the Lord of hosts, will I take thee, O Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, saith the Lord, and will make thee as a signet, for I have chosen thee, saith the Lord of hosts.
So, in that day, now, you know, that language right there, in that day, is ultimately pointing to the gospel era, and again, the fulfilling of the gospel era is going to be the millennial reign of Christ. So the rebuilding of the temple after the return from exile, that signaled a recognition of their theocratic state. They're heading back in that direction. And though chosen by a Persian monarch, right, Zerubbabel was actually, we're told here, chosen by the Lord to reestablish the Davidic dynasty. And he does so. Not only does he reestablish the Davidic dynasty, he appears in both genealogies of our Lord. You know, he's building him, if you will, his humanity. He's building. He's actually in that building too. He's here because God has chosen him, right? He's part of this work. Now, a signet ring was used to impress a seal on official documents, and Zerubbabel, and this is important. Because Zerubbabel is really, in one sense, typical of nations which are ruling in the fear of God. Right? These are nations ruling under Christ, ruling on behalf of Christ. And Zerubbabel is a seal of the Lord upon this undertaking. In other words, how do we know we're entering this millennial era? Well, the kingdoms of this world become the kingdoms of our Lord Jesus Christ. The nations rule. They bring in their wealth. They lend their support. They believe. The nations, as nations, confess. Okay, so this is a prophecy of a type of a political leader, a leader whose name means sown in Babylon. Remember mystic Babylon. Revelation talks about you know, Armageddon begins how? How's this Babylon brought down? One of the kings, one of the ten horns, turns and makes war against the whore. This is Zerubbabel. He's now ruling in the fear of the Lord. So, while the immediate scope, and this is important, the immediate scope of the prophecy is the building of the second temple. The antitype or the immediate scope is found in the gospel era, particularly Christ and his body, the church. But its remote reference is the glorious era that we call the millennium and the millennial church and the conversion of the nations. So the last message here, as Haggai sort of folds his ministry and we move into talking about the themes that we'll see in Zechariah, Haggai leaves it on this note. It's anticipatory of the coming of the kingdom in glory. It's anticipatory of the kingdoms of this world becoming the kingdoms of our Lord Jesus Christ. And so Haggai's message is not simply for the Jews who were just back from exile building a second temple. Had they themselves reflected upon it, they should have known that the ceremonies were not inherently efficacious. They were limited. They couldn't accomplish a spiritual end. There's nothing inherent about them that would accomplish that. And that should have made them look and yearn for answers to these questions. How can a man be just with God? And what does this all mean then? they should have then looked at this and understood that this second temple, in terms of being more glorious than the first, as had been promised by the prophets, they should have understood from that 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 can't be literal. It has to be spiritual. And it's looking for the gospel era. And it also points, again, to the fact that what happened in the early church can't possibly be the thing that is being viewed remotely here, because as successful as the Apostolic Church was, it didn't involve the shaking of the heavens and the earth, the sea and the dry land. It didn't involve this kind of universal upheaval and conversion of the nations. That doesn't occur until the sounding of the seventh trumpet at the end of the gospel era, at the beginning of what we call the millennium. All right. Next time, we'll begin looking at the prophecy of Zechariah and try to tie some of that into this framework.